The animals probably didn't know enough to run away. Some of the creatures that were lost were singularly spectacular, and would take a little managing if they were still around. Imagine ground sloths that could look into an upstairs window, a tortoises nearly the size of a small Fiat, monitor lizards 20 feet long, basking beside desert highways in Western Australia. Alas, they are gone, and we live on a much diminished planet. Today, across the whole world, only 4 types of really hefty, a metric ton or more, land animals survive. Elephants, rhinos, hippos, and giraffes. Not for tens of millions of years has life on Earth been so diminutive and tame. The question that arises is whether the disappearances of the Stone Age and disappearances of more recent times are in effect part of a single extinction event, whether, in short, humans are inherently bad news for other living things. The sad likelihood is that we may well be. According to the University of Chicago paleontologist David Raup, the background rate of extinction on Earth throughout biological history has been one species lost every 4 years on average. According to one recent calculation, human-caused extinction may now be running as much as 120,000 times that level. In the mid-1990s, the Australian naturalist Tim Flannery, now head of the South Australian Museum in Adelaide, became struck by how little we seem to know about many extinctions, including relatively recent ones. Wherever you looked, there seemed to be gaps in the records. Pieces missing, as with a dodo, or not recorded at all, he told me when I met him in Melbourne a year or so ago. Flannery recruited his friend Peter Shooton, an artist and fellow Australian, and together they embarked on a slightly obsessive quest to scour the world's major collections to find out what was lost, what was left, and what had never been known at all. They spent 4 years picking through old skins, musty specimens, old drawings and written descriptions, whatever was available. Shooton made life-sized paintings of every animal they could reasonably recreate, and Flannery wrote the words. The result was an extraordinary book called A Gap in Nature, constituting the most complete and, it must be said, moving catalogue of animal extinctions from the last 300 years. For some animals, records were good, but nobody had done anything much with them, sometimes for years, sometimes forever. Stella's sea cow, a walrus-like creature related to the dugong, was one of the last really big animals to go extinct. It was truly enormous. An adult could reach lengths of nearly 30 feet and weigh 10 tons. But we are acquainted with it only because in 1741 a Russian expedition happened to be shipwrecked on the only place where the creatures still survived in any numbers, the remote and foggy Commander Islands in the Bering Sea. Happily, the expedition had a naturalist, George Steller, who was fascinated by the animal. He took the most copious notes, says Flannery. He even measured the diameter of its whiskers. The only thing he wouldn't describe was the male genitals, though for some reason he was happy enough to do the females. He even saved a piece of skin, so we had a good idea of its texture. We weren't always so lucky. The one thing Stella couldn't do was save the sea cow itself. Already hunted to the brink of extinction, it would be gone altogether within 27 years of Stella's discovery of it. Many other animals, however, couldn't be included because too little is known about them. The Darling Downs hopping mouse, Chatham Island's swan, Ascension Island flightless crake, at least 5 types of large turtle, and many others are forever lost to us except as names. A great deal of extinction, Flannery and Shooton discovered, hasn't been cruel or wanton, but just kind of majestically foolish. In 1894, when a lighthouse was built on a lonely rock called Stephen's Island, in the tempestuous strait between the North and South Islands of New Zealand, the lighthouse keeper's cat kept bringing him strange little birds that it had caught. The keeper dutifully sent some specimens to the museum in Wellington. There a curator grew very excited because the bird was a relic species of flightless wrens, the only example of a flightless perching bird ever found anywhere. He set off at once for the island, but by the time he got there, the cat had killed them all. 12 stuffed museum species of the Stephen's Island flightless wren are all that now exist. At least we have those. All too often, it turns out, we are not much better at looking after species after they have gone than we were before they went. Take the case of the lovely Carolina parakeet, emerald green, with a golden head. It was arguably the most striking and beautiful bird ever to live in North America. Parrots don't usually venture so far north, as you may have noticed. And at its peak, it existed in vast numbers, exceeded only by the passenger pigeon. But the Carolina parakeet was also considered a pest by farmers, and easily hunted because it flocked tightly and had a peculiar habit of flying up at the sound of gunfire, as you would expect, but then returning almost at once to check on fallen comrades. In his classic American Ornithology, written in the early 19th century, Charles Wilson Peale describes an occasion in which he repeatedly empties a shotgun into a tree in which they roost. At each successive discharge, though showers of them fell, yet the affection of the survivors seemed rather to increase, for after a few circuits around the place, they again alighted near me, looking down on their slaughtered companions with such manifest symptoms of sympathy and concern as entirely disarmed me. By the second decade of the 20th century, the birds had been so relentlessly hunted that only a few remained alive in captivity. The last one, named Inca, died in the Cincinnati Zoo in 1918, not quite 4 years after the last passenger pigeon died in the same zoo, and was reverently stuffed. And where would you go to see poor Inca now? Nobody knows. The zoo lost it. What is both most intriguing and puzzling about the story above is that Peale was a lover of birds, and yet did not hesitate to kill them in large numbers for no better reason than that it interested him to do so. It is a truly astounding fact that for the longest time the people who were most intensely interested in the world's living things were the ones most likely to extinguish them. No one represented this position on a larger scale, in every sense, than Lionel Walter Rothschild, the second Baron Rothschild, scion of the great banking family. Rothschild was a strange and reclusive fellow. He lived his entire life in the nursery wing of his home at Tring in Buckinghamshire, using the furniture of his childhood, even sleeping in his childhood bed, though eventually he weighed 300 pounds. His passion was natural history, and he became a devoted accumulator of objects. He sent hordes of trained men, as many as 400 at a time, to every quarter of the globe to clamber over mountains and hack their way through jungles in the pursuit of new specimens, particularly things that flew. These were crated or boxed up, and sent back to Rothschild's estate at Tring, where he and a battalion of assistants exhaustively logged and analysed everything that came before them, producing a constant stream of books, papers, and monographs, some 1,200 in all. Altogether, Rothschild's Natural History Factory processed well over 2 million specimens, and added 5,000 species of creature to the scientific archive. Remarkably, Rothschild's collecting efforts were neither the most extensive nor the most generously funded of the 19th century. That title almost certainly belongs to a slightly earlier, but also very wealthy, British collector named Hugh Cumming, who became so preoccupied with accumulating objects that he built a large ocean-going ship and employed a crew to sail the world full-time, picking up whatever they could find, birds, plants, animals of all types, and especially shells. It was his unrivalled collection of barnacles that passed to Darwin and served as the basis for his seminal study. However, Rothschild was easily the most scientific collector of his age, though also the most regrettably lethal, for in the 1890s he became interested in Hawaii, perhaps the most temptingly vulnerable environment Earth has yet produced. Millions of years of isolation had allowed Hawaii to evolve 8,800 unique species of animals and plants. Of particular interest to Rothschild were the island's colourful and distinctive birds, often consisting of very small populations inhabiting extremely specific ranges. The tragedy for many Hawaiian birds was that they were not only distinctive, desirable, and rare, a dangerous combination in the best of circumstances, but also often heartbreakingly easy to take. The great Koa finch, an innocuous member of the honey creeper family, lurked shyly in the canopies of koa trees. But if someone imitated its song, it would abandon its cover at once and fly down in a show of welcome. The last of the species vanished in 1896, killed by Rothschild's ace collector Harry Palmer. 5 years after the disappearance of its cousin, the lesser Koa finch, a bird so sublimely rare that only one has ever been seen, the one shot for Rothschild's collection. Altogether, during the decade or so of Rothschild's most intensive collecting, at least 9 species of Hawaiian birds vanished. But it may have been more. Rothschild was by no means alone in his zeal to capture birds at more or less any cost. Others, in fact, were more ruthless. In 1907, when a well-known collector named Allenson Bryan realized that he had shot the last 3 specimens of black marmos, a species of forest bird that had only been discovered the previous decade, he noted that the news filled him with joy. It was, in short, a difficult age to fathom. A time when almost any animal was persecuted if it was deemed the least bit intrusive. In 1890, New York State paid out over 100 bounties for eastern mountain lions, even though it was clear that the much-harassed creatures were on the brink of extinction. Right up until the 1940s, many states continued to pay bounties for almost any kind of predatory creature. West Virginia gave out an annual college scholarship to whoever brought in the most dead pests, and pests was liberally interpreted to mean almost anything that wasn't grown on farms or kept as pets. Perhaps nothing speaks more vividly for the strangeness of the times than the fate of the lovely little Buckman's warbler. A native of the southern United States, the warbler was famous for its unusually thrilling song, but its population numbers, never robust, gradually dwindled until by the 1930s the warbler vanished altogether and went unseen for many years. Then in 1939, by happy coincidence, 2 separate birding enthusiasts in widely separated locations came across lone survivors just 2 days apart. They both shot the birds. And that was the last that was ever seen of Buckman's warblers. The impulse to exterminate was by no means exclusively American. In Australia, bounties were paid on the Tasmanian tiger, properly the thylacine, a dog-like creature with distinctive tiger stripes across its back, until shortly before the last one died, forlorn and nameless, in a private Hobart zoo in 1936. Go to the Tasmanian Museum today and ask to see the last of this species, the only large carnivorous marsupial to live into modern times, and all they can show you are photographs. The last surviving thylacine was thrown out with the weekly trash. I mention all this to make the point that if you were designing an organism to look after life in our lonely cosmos, to monitor where it is going, and keep a record of where it has been, you wouldn't choose human beings for the job. But here's an extremely salient point. We have been chosen by fate, or providence, or whatever you wish to call it. As far as we can tell, we are the best there is. We may be all there is. It's an unnerving thought that we may be the living universe's supreme achievement and its worst nightmare simultaneously. Because we are so remarkably careless about looking after things, both when alive and when not, we have no idea, really none at all, about how many things have died off permanently, or may soon, or may never, and what role we have played in any part of the process. In 1979, in the book The Sinking Ark, the author Norman Myers suggested that human activities were causing about 2 extinctions a week on the planet. By the early 1990s, he had raised the figure to some 600 per week. That's extinctions of all types, plants, insects, and so on, as well as animals. Others have put the figure even higher, to well over 1,000 a week. A United Nations report of 1995, on the other hand, put the total number of known extinctions in the last 400 years at slightly under 500 for animals and slightly over 650 for plants, while allowing that this was almost certainly an underestimate, particularly with regard to tropical species. A few interpreters think most extinction figures are grossly inflated. The fact is, we don't know. Don't have any idea. We don't know when we started doing many of the things we've done. We don't know what we are doing right now, or how our present actions will affect the future. What we do know is that there is only one planet to do it on, and only one species of being capable of making a considered difference. Edward O. Wilson expressed it with unimprovable brevity in The Diversity of Life. One planet, one experiment. If this book has a lesson, it is that we are awfully lucky to be here, and by we, I mean every living thing. To attain any kind of life in this universe of ours appears to be quite an achievement. As humans, we are doubly lucky, of course. We enjoy not only the privilege of existence, but also the singular ability to appreciate it, and even, in our multitude of ways, to make it better. It is a talent we have only barely begun to grasp. We have arrived at this position of eminence in a stunningly short time. Behaviorally modern human beings, that is, people who can speak, and make art, and organize complex activities, have existed for only about 0.0001% of Earth's history. But surviving for even that little while has required a nearly endless string of good fortune. We really are at the beginning of it all. The trick, of course, is to make sure we never find the end. And that, almost certainly, will require a good deal more than lucky breaks. This concludes the reading of A Short History of Nearly Everything by Bill Bryson. Copyright 2003 by Bill Bryson. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated, and was produced in 2003 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. This book was read by Richard Matthews. Books on Tape produces many new audiobook titles each month. To find out more about them, call our customer service department at the number which appears on this package, or visit us at our website, www.booksontape.com.